You're with Clement Magnatella.
702.
What an honor to be hosting Professor Patrick Lumumba in studio this morning. He is one of the leading public speakers we have. He has the heart for the continent of Africa. When he speaks, he inspires, but he also gives hope. And that's certainly how I feel every time I've watched his lectures, and I've watched many of his lectures. And I walk away not only understanding the challenges we face on the continent, but I walk away with the hope for a better Africa. And I have the pleasure, I had that pleasure last night to see him at a gala dinner at the Maslow Hotel. He has been brought here in the country by Reverend Matebula from Hope Ministries, and he came for a conference that they had yesterday. And I'm so grateful to both Reverend Matebula and the Prof for making this conversation possible for us. Prof, welcome back to South Africa. Welcome back home. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm happy to be with you this morning.
I think I want us to start off where you started yesterday when you addressed us last night at the gala dinner about the concept of a devoted citizen. You have traveled across this continent. You've seen, you've lived, you have experienced. Are we devoted citizens of this continent? Are we invested in its success?
The truth be told, the evidence on the ground demonstrate that our devotion is half-hearted. It is half-hearted because we say with our mouths what we do not believe in our hearts. And when one talks about a devoted citizen, one talks about a citizen who is conscious of his or her surroundings, one who is conscious that there is great work to do in the continent of Africa, one who is conscious that the continent of Africa can only be built by her sons and daughters, one who is conscious that democracy can only be sustained if we hold those who occupy positions of leadership to be accountable. And such citizens are few and far between. Yet, even as I say so, there is, as I walk across the continent of Africa, an emerging army of young men and women who are now clear in their minds that this continent can only be built by her sons and daughters. And that is what gives me hope and joy at once.
How devoted are our leaders? Over the last few decades, the continent has been celebrating its independence from colonization. Liberation movements have always had plans to build this continent that they've always dreamt of. But years later, we're talking about an Africa that is still far behind in terms of economic growth, education, just infrastructure development. Africans are still living in dire conditions. And you could argue that the problem is poor governance, lack of accountability, corruption. But isn't the root of all of these challenges poor leadership?
Without doubt, we have men and women in positions of leadership who largely do not care about the continent. You and me must learn from history and learn from the forefathers and the founders of our post-colonial nations. When you listen to them, the conviction, the dedication, the clarity with which they could see our problem, the diagnosis that they made about what our problems were, we were to fight poverty. We were to fight disease. We were to fight ignorance. We were to use our resources, both natural and human, for purposes of catapulting the continent from the muck and mire of desperation to the hard ground of hope. But every other election cycle, we see men and women who, upon occupying positions of authority, suddenly suffer from amnesia. And what they do is to use those positions for primitive accumulation of resources. They tell us they are going to build schools, but they have no faith in those schools. Their children will never go to those schools. They tell us they are building our hostels, and they themselves and their families will never do that. They steal money and they invest that money outside of the continent. The curse of Africa is the quality of the men and women who occupy political spaces. That is not to say that there are not a few positive examples. They are across the continent, but on a scale of 1 to 10, only 2 fit the bill.
So why are we not rising up as Africans against these politicians, even when we see we are being manipulated and we're being used as pawns?
You know, sometimes I ask myself, why are we so docile? And when one rises or a few rise, the majority are quick to condemn them. They want to disrupt what they call peace. And the politicians know this. They know that they have succeeded in hypnotizing us. They hypnotize us through ethnicity. They say, he's doing the wrong things or she's doing the wrong things, but he's from my ethnic group. Therefore, let me not muddy the waters. We are too docile. We don't raise the questions. We still wrongly believe that leaders are given to us by God. Wrong. God does not give people, men and women, whose only claim to fame is to destroy their countries. Our docility is our undoing. But yet, history demonstrates that Africans were not always docile. When the colonialists were here, we rose up, at least our forefathers did. In this country, in South Africa, I remember so very vividly how leaders were rising from those early days. If it was not Albert Luthuli, it was Pixley Kaisa Kaseme. If it was not Kaisaka, it was Sobukwe. If it was not Sobukwe, it was Mandela. If it was not Mandela, it was O.R. Tambo. If it was not O.R. Tambo, it was Albertina Sisulu or Madikizela, Mandela. And even later, we saw people rising. Where is that spirit? I choose to name those who are long gone because they are safer. They'll commit no other mistakes. But those who are alive are still there. Where is the spirit that gave birth to the Sharpeville massacre? Where is the spirit that gave birth to Soweto? Where is that spirit?
What do you think changed? The politicians we have are so obsessed with power. It's by hook or crook. And I wonder how we can make power less attractive. Because when people are saluting you, they're driving you around, you've got blue lights, you know, that can get into your head. Hence, many leaders hang on to those positions and they even kill for the position. So how do we make it less attractive and more about what you do in the interest of people and not so much what you benefit when you get into those positions?
If there is a set of individuals who give meaning to the phrase power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, it is the African politician. And they get intoxicated with temporal political power. As you've rightly said, immediately you occupy political office, suddenly you have a diplomatic passport. Suddenly, you don't obey traffic rules. Suddenly, you have allowances for everything. Suddenly, you become a demigod. And when you treat people as gods for too long, they begin to believe that they are gods. They have a sense of entitlement. How do we make it less attractive? We must now ask ourselves what we can do to reduce the perks that they get. And we can learn from other civilizations. In countries such as Cuba, you don't get paid the absurd amounts of money that people get paid. You don't cease to obey the law simply because you are a politician, a president, or a cabinet minister. You continue to do what other citizens do. You just have the honor and privilege of serving. Easier said than done, but history has demonstrated that we can demand of them. I had the privilege in my younger day of learning under the feet of Mwalimu Kambarage Nyerere of Tanzania. Humility personified. He told the people, during my life, don't name any public edifice after me. He did not use his office for personal accumulation. And he was clear that being the president of his country was an honor and privilege. that spirit is long gone. And politics now in Africa has become the shortest avenue to acquisition of ill-gotten political wealth. And the tragedy is that the majority of us who are led also celebrate these thieves. As long as we celebrate them, we too are co-authors of our own misfortune. The sooner we wake up, the safer we are. And I've seen it in Africa. When people have risen, I saw it in Sudan, when people rose and their president was removed from office and is in jail as I speak. I saw it, and we are still seeing in Sri Lanka, when the people rose up and the president left the country. It can be done. It is our duty to conquer fear and to wear the garbs of responsible courage. And that is why we talk about the devoted citizen who will not sit, because he or she knows that if he or she sits without doing anything, then this generation and generations yet to be born will suffer and suffer immensely.
And I hope that message gets to all of our hearts. I want us to talk about African unity now. And I wonder if you think we are still united as the continent of Africa. You've said before that for us to understand the present, we must understand the past, because that gives us a glimpse into what the future holds. And I would like us to take a few steps to the past. When European powers assembled in Berlin in the 1800s, 1884, 1885, they agreed to divide Africa into these spheres of influence for purposes of exploitation. Have we managed as the continent to dismantle what they intended at that conference?
No, you know, when they sat, I think it was from the month of November 1884 through to the month of February 1885. They had been in this continent, they were quarreling, and then they said, why are we quarreling? Why don't we divide it into our spheres of influence? It is as if it was as if hunters had gathered and say, let us each take our hunting ground. You hunt in, you the French hunt in West Africa, you the British hunt in southern and eastern Africa, you the Portuguese hunt in southern and eastern Africa, in Mozambique and Angola, you the Belgians hunt in the heart of Africa, you the Italians hunt in the northern part of Africa, you the Dutch hunt in the southern part of Africa. That is how they divide. You the Spaniards hunt in the armpit of Africa, in Equatorial Guinea. They succeeded. They came and told us our spirit and our God and our orientation to God was wrong. They told us that our language was wrong. They told us that our culture was primitive, and they told us the only cultural thing we have are our traditional dances. They lowered our self-esteem, and then they gave us languages so that today when we talk, we say we are Anglophone because we speak English. We say we are Lusophone because we speak Portuguese. We say we are Francophone and even Arabophone. Then we fought for our independence and regained independence. Then they allowed us, so we thought we had our national anthems, and we sing them ever so enthusiastically. Our national motto and our national vision and our national flowers and our national animals and coat of arms. But yet, the infrastructure for the neo-colonial project was also being introduced, and they introduced visas so that when I want to come to South Africa, I need a visa. When you want to come to Kenya, you need a visa. They gave us our currencies. You have your rand, we have our shilling, they have their franc, they have their metical, they have their kwanza, their cedi and naira. They divided us. And as I speak today, even as I remember the efforts in 1963 by the founding fathers and mothers to unite us so that we can have one currency, have one army, have one agenda, have one foreign policy, they were there lurking in the shadows and persuading us that this unity was not in our best interest. So today, African countries are much more wedded to the Commonwealth because they were colonized by the British, or the former French colonies, or the former British colonies, or the former Portuguese colonies, and our African Union, which was the new name we adopted after the Organization of African Unity, is weak. Manipulated, controlled largely from outside, financed by the French, financed by the Chinese. We are disunited. We are weak. We are suspicious of one another. We don't see ourselves as one body, and our weakness is a multi-million dollar industry for other civilizations.
Because they benefit,
of course,
when we are weak. At what point are we going to be united?
The beauty is that there is now a group of men and women who are beginning to recognize that the antidote to our disunity is unity, and the antidote to our multiple problems, be they economic and political, is unity. It is slow and painful and sometimes frustrating, but as I walk through the continent of Africa, I see that groundswell. I see the rhetoric changing. I see us saying that we must begin to trade with one another. Of course, they'll always be the fifth columnists who want to destroy this movement towards unity. We are beginning to have the scales moved from our eyes and the wax removed from our ears. It is not going to be easy. It is easier said than done. It's not going to happen as fast as we want it. It is not going to be an instant coffee solution or a microwave solution. It is block by block, block by block, from one generation to another. But as Kwame Nkrumah once said, we must keep on moving. And as others have said, the forward motion must be there. Whether we are crawling or sprinting, we must move forward.
Yeah, and Kwame Nkrumah has always even said, when Ghana got its independence, that it means nothing if the whole of the continent
is not
united.
And how right was him, the Osagie, for Kwame Nkrumah, prophetic as he was in those early days.
What's the solution then? What kind of this one Africa are we looking at? I mean, we still don't have one currency, no one passport, no connectivity between countries, no one code. We don't have a single Africa. We don't have a regional army. Do you think a federal government would be an answer?
You know, those who listen to some of us talking about African unity always say, but that is naive. That is idealistic. That is sentimental. If I was asked today what should be the structure of that united Africa, first of all, it would be an Africa that is united in our diversity. What structure of government would I recommend? A confederal system.
Confederal.
Confederal in the sense that we have a center that coordinates our currency, a center that deals with our foreign policy, a center that deals with our army, but allow the component units to control the other major things, such as policing and general governance. It can be done. A center that is headquartered, as some say, of already we have a working headquarter in Addis Ababa, that would be the headquarters. And then a center that is merely coordinating and not disrupting our unique governance system. A center that presides and allows our diversity. Traditional modes of governance would thrive in an environment which allows for democratic participation of the people. A confederal system is what I see, because through that confederal system, Africa suddenly becomes one. You and me don't need passports. You and me are working on the basis of a single currency. You and me are working on the basis of an education system that is largely uniform. You and me are working on railway systems, or an environment where there is free movements of goods and services and peoples. You and me are working on a system and in a system that is one. You and me are working in a country with one code, telephone code. You and me are working in a banking system that does not depend on SWIFT. You and me are working in a single country with a market of 1.6 billion. Well, you just imagine that country. Just imagine that market.
As scary as this question may be, I have to ask it before we do the headlines. Do you think this disunity is breeding ground for Africa to be recolonized in the many years to come? And colonization can take other forms. It may not be in the form that it took when it happened for the first time on this continent. Are we running that risk?
Oh, without doubt. And as you rightly have identified, it's not going to be colonization that you have governors coming here. They'll allow us to play our politics. The new colonization is going to be economic and cultural. And we can already see it. We can already see the kind of borrowing that we are engaged in, either from China or from the European Union or from the Americans and the Turks. We can already see the Chinese with their Confucius Institute. We can already see the British post-Brexit very active in the African continent. We can already see the Americans bringing in their military here. We can already see the French having and renewing their energy in Niger. If we remain disunited, we'll remain susceptible to manipulation, and we will be recolonized, albeit in a very subtle way.
Sure. It's just after 11:30.
7:02.
The Clement Maniatela Show.
Let's walk the talk.
All right, let's continue our conversation with Professor Patrick Lumumba. I have been getting goosebumps just listening to him, and I know some of you want to call in, have a question. I'm 011-883-0702. Prof, I'm going to ask you to please put on the earphones. Mutsumi in Boksburg, good morning.
Morning, and thank you very much, Clement, for taking my call. Professor, it is indeed an honor talking to you. First question, very quickly. How do we continue to inculcate and plant the seed to the future generations about Pan-Africanism in the eyes of Nkrumah, Sankara, and all that? Second question. Now that we've got a situation whereby the haves and the capitalists are identifying rich families, or they create rich leaders in order to lead countries, and we therefore end up with franchised branch of governments that are not really independent. How do we solve those problems?
Wonderful. Mutsumi, thank you so much for that. Prof, Mutsumi asking about the French franchised branch of government, and also asking about Pan-Africanism. How do we implant that true spirit of Pan-Africanism?
Thank you very much. There are quite a number of things that are happening, not as visible as they ought to be. We have existing institutions such as the African Union, which is weak. I know we have the Pan-African Parliament, which is not strong. I know we have the African Union Youth, which could be re-energized. My view is that we must energize these institutions, and civil societies must also be involved in ensuring that these institutions work on the basis of their declared mandate. If they do so, then the institutions will begin to perform as they should. Outside of the formal institutions, voices such as yours and mine must also remain alive, because history has demonstrated that in the struggle to inculcate the idea of Pan-Africanism, voices must remain alive and well. Remember that when African countries were struggling to regain their independence, it was the collectivity of the voices that brought about the collapse of the colonial administration. Here in South Africa, you will remember that the apartheid regime collapsed because there was a multiplicity of voices from the trade unions, from the religious sector, from the political sector, from the women. All these efforts joined together are going to ensure that the Pan-Africanist idea is given its pride of place. It is also important that we begin to look at our education. I've gone to African countries where they don't teach history. How can you not teach history of your country, history of your continent? We must make history mandatory. We must make history of the struggle in Africa mandatory, because it is only in that way that we will rekindle this enthusiasm that is ever so necessary in the fight to keep the flame of Pan-Africanism alive. Your second question is, how do we ensure that we don't have in positions of leadership? And I'm always very deliberate. I don't use the word leader very often, because the men and women we have in positions of leadership are not necessarily leaders. They are misleaders, many of them. And what they have succeeded in doing is to manipulate us. Quite a number of them are actually marionettes who are being controlled from outside through invisible lines that we do not see. And it is our duty to identify and to expose them. You go to a number of African countries, you go to Cameroon, for example. You have a president who spends half of his time outside of the country. You go to a number of countries, they are simply people who have been brought there as if they are plantation supervisors for the former colonizers. What must we do is we must expose them. We must always ensure that we talk about and against them and tell them that they have a duty to us, not to people who are outside of the continent. And I want to repeat this again. Democracy is only sustained by the eternal vigilance of the people. If you are not vigilant, history has demonstrated that those in positions of leadership will abandon the object of the reasons why they were elected into office. And it is our duty to ensure that they don't. And if they don't, we remove them from office through democratic means. And democratic means sometimes even means a revolution. I've just seen in Sri Lanka what they have done. They went and occupied the presidential palace. That is democracy. If the ballot cannot work, then people power, boots on the ground, must be given its pride of place.
Things are looking bad in most, well, some parts of the continent. I mean, when you look at the state of our continent, when you talk about conflict, you know, northern Mozambique, Somalia, Ethiopia, South Sudan, you know, the Central African Republic, the DRC, Mali, Niger, Cameroon, Nigeria, and there's just conflict, and things are not looking that good here on home soil. It may not be as bad as what other countries are experiencing. And I wonder what your assessment is of our leaders here. You know, some have referred to us as South Africa as the so-called big brother on the continent. Are we playing that role effectively? And what do you think of the leaders we have under this liberation movement now?
Let me preface my answer. On the 14th day of November 2021, I wrote to all the presidents of Africa, all of them. And I caused my letter to be delivered to all of them. 10 responded to my letter. And I said that Africa has remained where it is because we say many things through resolutions and we don't deliver. And that I am urging them to consider convening a heads of state summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, with only 3 agenda items. Number 1, what is wrong? Number 2, what can we do about it? And number 3, within what period can we resolve these problems? Because in many African countries, people are beginning to ask, was it better while we waited? And that is an unfortunate question to be asked. South Africa, I was alive and well and an adult when I used to see the many forays of O.R. Tambo when he was in exile. I saw the forays of people like Thabo Mbeki. We read about the great fighters such as Nelson Mandela, Chris Hani, and about the tribulations of people like Sobukwe, the tribulations of Walter Sisulu, Albertina Sisulu, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, the voices of people like Desmond Mpilo Tutu, Alan Busack, and the promises made at that time is that with the death of apartheid, things would change dramatically. The expectations of the people was that it would be so dramatic that immediately housing problems would be resolved. Poverty would be killed. The hospitals would become better. Education would become more accessible to the young people. Employment opportunities would suddenly change. Of course, the change has not been as dramatic. That the land question would be resolved. These were the things that the people expected to happen almost in the twinkling of an eye. 28 years down the line, the pace in the view of many is the pace of a tortoise and the steps of a chameleon. And people are getting impatient. It is true that South Africa remains the bigger economy. And I think people are becoming angry in South Africa because some of the people that they entrusted with positions of power and leadership are using those opportunities to steal. When they look at the money that is being stolen in the municipalities, when they hear about the Guptas and how they were running roughshod over this country, they're saying, but we sent you there to do certain things. How is it that the Guptas are the ones who have captured this? This is the source of the anger. And the sooner the political leadership realize that they must pause and take steps back, people may begin to ask other questions which will be very uncomfortable. South Africa can do better, has the opportunity to do better. Look at the resources that you have, both natural and human. If they are harnessed together, this country should be a $1 trillion GDP economy in the next 10 years.
But do we have the right leadership to take this country forward? Yes, when you spoke earlier about things moving at a snail's pace, we were told, seek ye first the political kingdom and all shall come. But it's been coming so slow. Do you have confidence that, from what you've observed, the leadership we have now can take us forward and make us such a prosperous country that we are capable of being?
I think there is too much hesitancy on the part of the leadership that we have now. I think they could do better. I think that there is a sense in which people are too comfortable in their positions. And I think people are beginning to say, we thought you could do better, but you are not. Why are you resting on your laurels? But I hold the view that there are men and women who are currently not in positions of leadership who, if given the opportunity and kept on a short leash, this is very important, given the opportunity to serve and kept on a short leash, will deliver. All of us are capable of abusing power if we are not kept on a short leash. And perhaps we thought when we entrusted these individuals with positions of leadership, we thought that they were Moses with a rod and staff in their hand, that they would part the Red Sea and summon manna to come from heaven. They are not. There is a part of them that is selfish. They want to be multi-millionaires. And if we don't keep them on a short leash, they are going to disappoint us. I repeat again, democracy is only sustained by the eternal vigilance of the people and by leaders who are kept on a short leash so that if they want to behave like pariahs, they are removed sooner rather than later.
You've spoken a lot about liberation movement. How much lifespan do you think the ANC still has?
You know, let me be very candid about African liberation movements. The transition from a liberation movement to a political party that is responsible can be very difficult. Because those who were in the liberation struggle sometimes have a sense of entitlement. They ask the people, where were you when we were in the trenches? And sometimes they behave as if the country owes them. They behave as if the country owes them so that when they are in positions of power and they take money from the public till they say, but we are compensating ourselves.
We were in prison.
We were in prison. You are not there. And if you, even if you are there, you are not born. We bore the brunt of abuse and insults. You cannot question us. We are infallible. That is wrong. History gave them the opportunity of serving their country. Some paid the ultimate price, died, never to experience the fruits of democracy. But that humility is as rare as the egg of an elephant.
Shoo. Lambrecht, you're calling us from Kempton Park. Good morning.
Good morning, Clement. How are you?
Sharp, sharp. Go ahead.
Good morning, Professor. I just want to ask you a question about the Eastern Africa. What do you say when you're seeing Rwanda, Uganda, Burundi attacking Congo, making war to Congo, 12 million people dying, the United Nations report, Mamping report, saying it's Rwanda attacking Congo, but you're telling us to reunite, but what do you say? I never heard you about talking about Rwanda attacking Congo.
We have a problem, and I've talked about it. I talked about it even last week, that part of the problem that we have in what are called the regional economic blocks is suspicion. We have an East African community which brings together Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, South Sudan, and now the DRC. And we know and we have heard that there are elements which are operating in Eastern Congo that are supported by governments such as the government of Rwanda, the government of Uganda. And we know that there was suspicion between Rwanda and Uganda. We know that there is suspicion between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. And we know, as I speak, that the government of the DRC has even banned Rwanda from operating in Congo. And recently in Nairobi, we had a summit of all heads of states in Nairobi to resolve this dispute. The problem with politics in the East African region and in Africa generally is that when people meet at fora such as that, they are polite with each other, and the first casualty is truth. Truth dies because strategic interests preoccupy the better part of the conversation. And secondly, remember that these colonizers that I keep talking about, they also would love a Congo that is unstable. A Congo that is unstable is a hunting ground for very many organizations in the West and in different parts of the world. So I can't agree with you more that it is common knowledge that Congo is a country that has been raped by her neighbors or elements within the neighborhood, and the sooner that is resolved, the better. It pains me that we have an organization which is East African, and yet it is the Angolan president who is mediating between Congo and Rwanda. It doesn't make sense.
Pumzile says, hi, Clement. Please, can you ask the prof what his thoughts are on ageism across the African continent leadership, with the average age in Africa being in the early 20s? How can we move away from government leaders in their 60s and above towards more younger leaders to take up public office to fix our countries and our continent?
Thank you very much. First of all, I am one who believes that there should be intergenerational succession in power, succession in politics and in business. But age in and of itself is not a magic bullet. Age in and of itself. I've seen younger leaders who are worse than older leaders, and we have seen them in the continent. So in as much as age and transition is a good thing, I am one who thinks that we should have men and women who are capable of leading their countries properly. And if the population wants younger leaders, the demographics in Africa are quite clear. This is the youngest continent, yet somehow the young are manipulated, and when the voters are given a choice between the young and the old, they keep on electing the old, and the following day they start complaining. However, I am of the view that those in positions of leadership must make a deliberate effort to ensure that there is proper transition. Because when people are younger and are enthusiastic and they are properly guided, there is a sense in which they have the capacity to deliver more. But remember that In many African countries now, those in positions of leadership have succeeded in making leadership a family heirloom, where father is succeeded by son. We are creating de facto monarchies in Africa to the detriment of the continent. And once again, I say, young people, arise. Stop complaining. Stop lamenting. Stop being keyboard warriors. Mm. When you are keyboard warriors, you'll only deliver as much as the keyboard permits you. Go out there and vote and ensure that you change your continent and your countries. It can't be done through the ballot.
Mm. Prof, it was such an honor to have you in studio, and thank you so much for your insights. Thank you so much for your wisdom and for inspiring us to take our rightful place, especially in young people. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and I wish you the very best. It's